You are now listening to the Photography Enthusiast Podcast. Hello and welcome to another episode of the Photography Enthusiast Podcast. As always, I am your host, Daniel Lee, or Photos by DLEE. Today, we're going to be discussing what gear to bring when traveling, some news topics and the usual personal updates, which will start right now. So I have actually been shooting again a bit. So the other day I went to a place called Dudley Page Reserve in Sydney. It's actually quite high up. It's in the eastern suburbs near Dover Point Heights and Point Wills. I always forget the name of these suburbs because I don't actually go there. Watson's Bay, sorry. I'm thinking of Perth suburbs because my wife is in Perth at the moment. But yeah, near Watson's Bay and Dover Heights. So it's a park, just like a normal open air park kind of thing, but the view is really, really nice. So photos for that will be out in a day or two on photosbydlee.com, part of my new blog post. It is pretty tiring for me to go out and shoot sunset now because, you know, the light was really good, like blue hour around 7:45 a.m. So by the time I head home, it's like 8:30 already, a shower, you know, and I only got like 30 minutes to relax before I need to sleep, or sometimes even, you know, some nights I'm sleeping already by 9 or 9:30 kind of thing recently. So, you know, it's pretty tiring. I don't really like it. I think I prefer to try sunrise if possible, because sunrise is about 5:45. And, you know, I'm more of a morning person because I've been waking up really early to watch wrestling. I feel like getting up early is easier than staying out late. Probably the opposite to most people, but yeah, that's how I am. That day, you know, made me very tempted to, gave me a bit of gas about a new tripod. The reason for that is it was really, really windy there, and I felt like the Suray one that I use isn't that great anymore. I don't know why. For a while, I felt like it was really solid, really stable. Maybe, I don't know, because it's carbon fiber. Maybe over time, it's just sort of relaxed a bit in a sense, and that's why it's not as sturdy as it used to be. But, you know, also there's the fact that with my Manfrotto one I previously had, which was now really expensive, I wanted to rebuy it, so that's an issue. That one you can do very low to the ground, whereas this one you really can't do it. I do have the travel one as well. So what I'm going to do about it, I don't know if I'll buy another tripod. The moment, you know, I just try and sit on any gear decisions I have and just leave it. Instead, I've been trying to upgrade my PC, which I did. I, you know, have had it for about 5 years now. I had two terabyte drives. One of them was pretty, well, both of them are fairly full, less than 1 terabyte storage left. So I wanted to upgrade. I did upgrade one. The one with all my shows and all that kind of stuff on it, I put an 8 terabyte drive in there, so that one's going to be good for a very long time to come. I was meant to upgrade my photos one as well, but I didn't end up buying the drive when I was meant to, and now I'm pretty lazy to do it, in all honesty, because it's not like heaps of work, but it is a bit of a hassle having to open up the side, you know, get that extra cable in, which my cable management is pretty bad right now, so it's actually quite hard to get the case on and off. Plus, just the copying. Copying is actually pretty easy. I don't use cloning. Some people would clone the drives. I tend to do copy and paste, mainly because, you know, I've never really used a cloning feature. And with cloning, you have to clone the entire drive. Whereas I was sort of cleaning things up as I did it. I was only copying what I wanted to keep and forgetting about the rest. So that way I was doing both at the same time. The Fuji X-T5, which we're going to be talking about in the news, has me tempted to sell my XS10, not because I want the X-T5, but just because I feel like, what if the XS20 comes out soon? I don't want to lose any resale value on it, even though I fairly enjoy it. But, you know, at the same time, I wouldn't mind something like a Sony A7C, just have two full frame bodies and share all the lenses across the two, which could be quite interesting. It's something I'll have to, you know, just sit on for a while and see how I go. I'm not going to make any rash decisions. Otherwise, that's pretty much it for personal updates, and we'll get on to the news. So first, the Fujifilm X-T5 has been announced. So Fujifilm has announced the X-T5 camera, which utilizes the company's fifth generation 40.2 megapixel X-Trans CMOS HR sensor in a body that the company says is smaller than each of the three previous X-T cameras. It has a 40 megapixel backside illuminated CMOS sensor with X-Trans color filter array. It has up to 15 frames per second. IBIS is rated up to 7 EV, 3.69 million dot EVF, and a 1.4 million dot free axis tiltable LCD, dual UHS-II card slots, pixel shift mode, which combines 20 frames to generate a 160 megapixel image. Its AF utilizes deep learning tech, which helps it recognize animals, birds, vehicles, bikes, airplanes, and trains. It weighs 557 grams, comes in black and silver, and is available late November for $1,700 USD. For me personally, I'm not big on the XT series because it's all more manual dials, all that kind of stuff. I personally don't like the screen. As you know, I like fully articulating screen. At the least, you know, I would love to see screens like what's on the A7R 5 that does full tilt plus fully articulating. That is the best screen you can get pretty much in terms of function, since it does both and no one can complain about it. I feel like it's a step back going back to just a pure tilt screen, but that's just me. Others will likely prefer this. I also think 40 megapixels for me personally is a bit too high for APS-C. The higher the megapixels, the smaller each individual pixel is, which means the less light it can absorb and the more noise you're going to get. So for me, 40 is a bit too high. I think, you know, even 24, 26 is fine. Like, you don't really need more than that. I know some wildlife shooters will probably want more, but, you know, it's always a trade-off. If you're using APS-C, you would technically, you know, probably likely be shooting at a higher ISO. So the higher the noise, you know, the higher ISO, higher megapixels, the higher the noise. It's a trade-off. So it's sort of really up to you what you want in that camera. Next up, Fujifilm also announced the XF 30mm f2.8 lens. This was announced alongside of the X-T5, and it's a macro lens that features a 1:1 magnification ratio and a close focusing distance of just 3.94 inches or 10 centimeters from the sensor. So it's a full frame equivalent of 46mm, 11 elements in 9 groups, weather sealed in 9 locations to allow it to be both dust and weather resistant, and operate in temperatures as low as 14 degrees Fahrenheit or 10 degrees Celsius, sorry, minus 10 degrees Celsius. The 30mm f2.8 macro lens also uses the inner focus system, where the lens group is driven by a linear motor to achieve accurate focus in as fast as 0.02 seconds, even at macro distances. Fuji claims it's quiet and smooth in operation. It weighs only 195 grams, has a 43mm filter thread size, and it will be available late November 2022 for $599.95 USD. For me, I tend to like the longer focal length for macro. Some people like that, you know, look from a wide angle doing it. Me, always longer. Like, even when I had the 85mm f2, although that wasn't a full 1:1 macro, so that does make a difference in the reproduction, you know, magnification, it just was a bit too short for me. I would have much preferred something longer now. That's why if I'm going to get a macro lens again, it'll probably be the Sigma 105mm. But, you know, if you like wide lenses, this lens is very tiny. Great for travel if you do macro while you travel or something. Otherwise, yeah, that's it. Next up, the Canon EOS R6 Mark II has been announced. So this is what the company positions as a Swiss Army knife of a camera. It has a 24.2 megapixel CMOS sensor, which is not the same sensor as the R3, as it's not stacked and it is not BSI, so backside illuminated, which is pretty, you know, the R6 sensor was good. It didn't have any issues. So to me, this would be good, but it would have been nice if they could at least made it backside illuminated. It does have a sync speed of 1/200th of a second for the mechanical shutter and 1/250th for electronic, 12fps mechanical shutter or 40fps electronic shutter. In addition to the previously available intelligent autofocus capabilities, the R6 II also adds horses, trains, and airplanes, which are now detectable thanks to the updated deep learning technology, which I think every camera manufacturer is using now. It has IBIS up to 8 stops, which is usually, you know, when used with a lens with IS. Has raw burst mode with pre-capture. 3.68 million dot EVF capable of up to 120 frames per second. Refresh rate with a 0.76 times magnification. A 1.62 million dot 3-inch rear touchscreen. Fully articulating, of course. And dual UHS 2 card slots that have a battery usage of 760 shots per charge. And the retail price of $2,499. So for those in the US, it's pretty much the exact same as what the R6 was at launch. But even now, for us in Australia, I believe off the top of my head, it was advertised around $4,400 to $4,600 AUD. Keep in mind, the stores here love to advertise it much higher. Within, you know, a few months, 2 to 6 months, it'll already be down to like $3,500, $3,400, like how I bought my R6 original. On this camera, you know, someone did ask me in one of the comments if I was tempted by this camera to, you know, swap back again or I have FOMO. In my personal opinion, now this is just me, this camera does not interest me at all. The reason for that is the R6 was already everything that I wanted in the camera. There was literally the only thing I wanted, I wish they would have had on that camera, was zebra highlight warnings, which, you know, is just a firmware update. They could have literally added in the firmware update. Otherwise, there was nothing that I was unhappy about with that camera. There's, you know, maybe advancements to the electronic shutter, which I don't think this camera has actually received. So that's another thing I would have liked, but, you know, even this one doesn't have it. So to me personally, this camera is no real upgrade. When I left Canon, it wasn't due to the bodies being bad or anything. It was more about the lens range and lens pricing. That's purely what drove me to swap. So, you know, even though this is a great camera, even better built upon what was already an excellent near perfect camera, you know, 24 megapixels does nothing for me. This kind of, a lot of the upgrades do nothing for me. It's all about the lenses for me. And yeah, that's where Canon sort of have their issues for people like in Australia and that kind of stuff, and outside the US mainly. Well, it's raining outside as well, which I am happy to see. So next up, Canon RF 135mm f1.8 LIS USM has been announced. So this is a new prime lens for the RF mount. It's a lens that apparently, according to Canon, promises to achieve beautiful and generous bokeh and is ideal for both portraiture and sports photography due to, you know, focal length and that. It has a linear style autofocus motor. Thankfully, I know they wouldn't be putting their STM motor on there, but if they did, instant death to that lens. It has optical image stabilization that works in tandem with the IBIS. 17 elements arranged in 12 groups, including 3 UD lenses. Has a 9-bladed aperture, an 82mm filter thread. It weighs 935 grams and will be available January 2023, so several months away, for $2,099. Now, this is where my problem with this lens comes in. Don't get me wrong, looks like an amazing lens, image quality and everything, pricing. Now, I believe in the US, the G Master lens is around $2,000 USD. Now, this one is $2,099 USD. So in the US, this is an extremely competitive lens. If you only care about the 135mm focal length, you're looking to get a system, this is actually a very attractive option, and you could go with either Sony or Canon, and there's no issue. Now, in Australia, that's a different story. Here, so obviously so in the US, there's a $100 difference in favor of the GM. Here, the Sony GM, usually regularly, it's almost always on sale for around $2,300, usually around $2,600 sort of thing. So it's actually quite cheap, $2,300 AUD, almost the same price as the USD, except R2300 includes GST and everything. Now, in the RF lens, that is launching for around $3,800 AUD, including GST tax, all that kind of stuff. So it's more than like $1,500 more than the Sony GM. Now, go back to that same scenario. If you're a photographer in Australia, UK, I know the UK price difference is insane as well. If you're a photographer in one of these locations, you want a body and you want a lens, a 135mm prime. That's all you need for your portraits. Are you going to go for, the body is technically a very similar in pricing, especially here. Are you going to go for the, you know, even R6 or A7 Mark IV plus the GM for $2,300, or you want to spend $1,500 more to go for the Canon and get that RF 135L? I don't think so. This is what I mean. The pricing outside the US is insane for Canon. They have lost their minds. They need to be way more aggressive with their pricing. It's not like they have to make it cheaper than the Sony, even within range. If they made it like $2,700, if you really like Canon, you want to stick with Canon for the body, the ergonomics, you probably see that as more like worth getting it, and you don't have that hassle of trying to sell everything off and rebuy. So it would be worth it. But for $1,500 savings, I honestly, my 16-35mm F4G lens was $1,400, so I could buy that lens. My Sigma Art was only $1,100. I could buy that lens. The 35 GM was about $1,800. So, you know, add on $300, I could buy that lens. That is a big amount of money to spend on pretty much the same focal length. The RF lens does have IS, so there is that and a longer warranty. But is that really warrant $1,500 extra on the price? For me personally, I don't think so. I wouldn't want to pay that. If Canon gave me the option to have this lens with the same warranty length and no IS, I would take that $1,500 back and go buy another lens. That's just me though. That's pretty much it for the news. I went through it a bit quick today, trying to get through everything before I start coughing again. My next asthma attack coming soon, I can feel it. Otherwise, onto our main topic. So now, as you know, most borders are somewhat open now, so you can start to travel again. go to places without having to worry about quarantine, which means, you know, travel gear, everything, photography, travel photography should be able to start kicking up again so you can get ideas on what you want to do. For me personally, I am planning some holidays in 2022, so start saving, but I also have to start thinking about for me, I'm already thinking about what kind of camera gear I want to take. Because, you know, one of the places I want to go is Japan, which I've wanted to go for so long. So obviously that, you know, is big on my mind. And the gear I brought with me, the Bali, kind of let me down in some ways, kind of not, you know. So that's why I am really, really strongly considering what I want to take. So I thought this would make a great, you know, quick discussion about what my thoughts and mindset are, what is good to, you know, travel with, what isn't, that kind of stuff. So first I'll probably say what let me down. So when I went to Bali, I took my Fuji system and all I had was primes with me because I knew, you know, I wouldn't be able to shoot much. I took the 23mm, which is 35mm equivalent, and the 56 85mm equivalent, or 80, I can't remember which one. But either way, the main thing that let me down was there was a few locations where I would have loved to have something wider, like at the villa where we had our wedding, Alila Uluwatu. There was, you know, the palm trees, and I used the 23mm, but it just wasn't wide enough. I would have loved to have something wider. So if I had the Canon with me, I would have had the 16mm or, you know, at least something a bit wider. And it's really bucketing down out there. But otherwise, I, you know, would have had very different. So what I would start at when you're looking at what camera gear to take is what type of holiday is it? So is it a family trip? As you know, with family trips, they're not really like very artistic photography related. It's probably going to be more likely you, you know, just taking photos of food, your kids or partner, you know, like little bit of scenery, that kind of stuff. Not like go out, shoot cityscape, street, very intensive kind of stuff. So what you bring may be more about convenience than it would be about getting the shots you want. So like a Zoom kind of thing. Now, if it's a personal trip where you're going just for photography or just by yourself, maybe that's where you need to be more strict with what gear you want. If I was going somewhere like say Hong Kong just for photography, I would know exactly straight away. I would just need 85 and 35 prime and maybe that one 16 and 35 for the very occasional shot. But majority of the time, locked to my camera would be the 35 or the 85. So that's why the trip can really determine. And if you're going for work, you know, you may not even get the chance to shoot much. Maybe some very small camera, something pocketable like the X-EA4, like a Fuji camera with a pancake lens, that kind of thing. You can take that with you, just something you can keep in your bag. Isn't heavy, doesn't weigh you down, but if you see something you really want to capture, you still got that camera with you. And then the next question asks is how much you can focus on photography. So, you know, which ties into that. Family trip, probably not too much. Work trip, probably nothing at all. And personal trip, likely, you know, you can prioritize, especially if you're by yourself, you can prioritize photography as much as you want. Now, the next thing you should look at is what you want to shoot. So, like previous, if it's just casual stuff for memories, you know, where you ate at, a location you visited, that kind of stuff. Tickets, you know, when you go to Disneyland, you want to take photos, your ticket stubs, that kind of thing. You know, it's very casual, doesn't really matter. Say you take a prime, but you kind of wish, you know, there's a shot that you wanted. If it's just very casual, you take what you can. It doesn't matter. It's not imperative that you get that particular shot you wanted. Whereas, you know, if you're sort of going for more a pure photography trip, you want to get the best shots that you want, you need to be doing location scouting in Google. What I do is Instagram's honestly not that great. You can find a lot of photos from a location there, but not everyone adds their EXIF, and you also have just snapshots from everyone as well with their phones, which don't help anything. Sites like Flickr, honestly, that's where they really shine because people who have their EXIF data on, you can see, oh, this person shot from this angle here. This focal length was really wide, not wide enough, that kind of stuff. You can really get an idea and plan from there if you're planning to do more like professional shots or something you really want. For a mix of both, maybe, you know, sometimes if you got a safe at your hotel, it's easier just to overpack, bring another lens. You're better off having that lens with you sitting in the safe every day as a backup than you are not having that lens and missing out on something that you could have shot with. So it really depends on you. The next up is, you know, primes versus zoom. So for primes, you know, at home, that's my preferred way of shooting. I pretty much only shoot with primes aside from my 16 to 35. Although, you know, sometimes when traveling, you need that adaptability. You need something more convenient. So it may not be as good. But at the same time, if you want to be able to shoot in low light, normal daylight, that kind of stuff, you may prefer the prime for that fast aperture, especially if you got something like a 35-1.4 like me. I know, you know, 35 and 50, you can shoot majority of everything with those two focal, with one of those two focal lengths, depending on how you like to compose stuff. So for me, 35, I could literally just travel with that. You also do have, you know, say a 16 to 35, you have all of that, but then you're losing out two stops of, well, actually more than two. So from F4 to F2, so almost three stops of light if you use that F4 over an F1.4. So you do have that, take that into consideration, a big benefit of prime. But as I mentioned with the zooms, they are more useful on the very wide end and very far end. So what I mean is the difference between 35 and 50 isn't too bad. You could always crop in a bit, get a little bit closer if possible. It's not a huge noticeable difference, whereas the difference between 20 and 15 is insane. The amount of detail, extra detail you can get is 15 is a lot. So that's why usually I'd say anywhere from say 35 to 100 or even 24 to 100, you can get away with just primes. Whereas wider than 24 and longer than 100, I personally feel like zooms are better. Because, you know, if you're, say, somewhere you want to shoot this building and you have a 24 millimeter lens, you may not be able to back up anymore. And 24 may not be wide enough or close enough. That's where the zoom comes in. You know, if you got can zoom out to like 15 millimeters, easy. Just zoom out, get closer, whatever, like, you know, can do it, handle it all. The same with the long end. If you can't get any closer due to water being there, that's where that telephoto zoom comes in, can really be convenient and really help you out a lot. Now, location type. Certain places are favored by certain focal lengths due to their location, you know, and that kind of stuff, the way they're built around water. So for example, in Sydney, if you're shooting cityscapes from across, I don't even know what it's called, the harbor, across the harbor, there's no like actual, you know, Indian Ocean kind of thing. If you're shooting from across the harbor, say on the Kirribilli side, Piamont side, that kind of stuff, Piamont, then you're going to need to be using, technically I can get away with primes. 35 millimeter prime is good for most of the stuff. Whereas, you know, some places, like from what I've been told, I haven't been there in so long, so I can't remember. Joey in Singapore, my friend in Singapore, has told me, you know, you need more wide angle lenses because it's a smaller place. There's not as many spots to shoot from as far back like it is in Sydney. So something like a 16 to 35 would be more useful. Whereas, you know, here in Sydney, you could easily do 24 to 70. So location can really be beneficial and determine what gear is best. And that's where also, as I mentioned, before you go, doing your research really comes into play. Some of this stuff you won't know until you get there because, you know, Google, other people's photos can only be so helpful. And if you find a location that's sort of unexplored and unused, that's not very commonly used, it may be even harder to find information on it. And that's the type of thing you're not going to know till you're there. You have to guesstimate or at least take, you know, as much gear as you can, maybe two zooms, a 16 to 35 and a 24 to 70, just so that way you're covering absolutely everything. It's also sometimes a good excuse to buy new gear. Like for example, for my trip coming up, I don't know what to do about 85 millimeters. I love the look of my 85 art, but I don't know if I want to carry it all the way on a holiday with me because, you know, it's 600 grams. It's not super heavy, but it's not super light either. If I got something like the FE 85 millimeter F1.8, that one's only like 300-400 grams. So it would make it very easy to just carry around with me while I travel. And I was even thinking of buying it just for that, but whether I do or not, that's another thing. And then sometimes, you know, some people have gear just for travel. I actually tried that before. I bought a Tamron 28-75, which was meant to be my travel lens. I was only going to use it for travel, but because I actually personally don't travel that often, maybe once a year, once every 2 years, I didn't see the purpose in keeping a lens, letting it lose value just to sit around and not be used. So I ended up selling it. If you're the type of person that doesn't mind doing that, you can justify it. Having travel gear is excellent, you know? It's the best way to keep yourself going. If, for example, on Sony, you can buy the 17-28, 28-70, and then you're pretty much covered majority of ranges. And as I've said many times in this, standard focal lengths are your friends, you know? Like the fact that you can shoot pretty much anything with them makes things a lot easier for you and you have to carry less. That's pretty much my take on it. Hopefully something did help you there. I still have zero clue what I'm going to take for my travel. For me, you know, I really love my 35GM. I really want to take that and just use that 90% of the time. But I got my 16 to 35 as well. And when I went to San Francisco, I mainly shot with that lens. I just shot wide angle. Because you know when you're on holidays, you don't really care about anything with bokeh. You just want to capture everything. So that's why I thought of just taking the 16-35 and then my Fuji with the 56mm, Fuji with my 33mm as a 50mm as like a general walk around for anything I do want a shallow depth of field. But then I also thought, what if I sold that whole Fuji gear for the A7C and got the Samyang AF 50mm f1.42, which is a tiny light lens, so which would work out practically the same weight, but I have two Sony full frame cameras. So it's a really, really tough decision. I don't know what I'm going to do. I still got several months to decide it, but it's not easy. So yeah, we'll see how we go. Otherwise, thank you very much for listening. Hope you enjoyed this episode. If you did, please subscribe. I'd love it if you could leave a review on Apple Podcasts, that kind of stuff, and iTunes. Otherwise, just let me know. Hit me up on Twitter or anything if you have any suggestions. You know, there's a suggestion form for topics in the show notes. So if you want to suggest a topic I might be able to cover, I'm happy to give it a try as long as I got experience with that gear or that kind of stuff. Otherwise, you can find more podcasts, tutorials, reviews on thephotographyenthusiast.com. I'm also working on a Sony review, starting to work on the A7 IV review, so that will come soon. Not too quick. Pokemon comes out this Friday, so that will delay me. I can promise you that. Otherwise, if you want to follow me personally, photosbydoe.com. Pretty much photosbydoe on Twitter, Reddit, pretty much all that. All these links are in the show notes. You can find them there. Thank you very much for listening. Stay safe out there. Buy as much camera gear as you like and see you in a fortnight. Bye.